Good afternoon. So last time we talked about page replacement. We mentioned that it's the same as allocation. When we allocate a page, typically we assume that hopefully we're using all our memory to cache stuff. So we're going to have to remove something from that cache in order to allocate a new page. That generally will be part of our cache. We mentioned, if we want to maximize hit rate, we have this idea called Belady's min, assuming we're entirely reactive. Which is we look furthest in the future. We can't actually implement that, so we need to look at what data we do have. We don't actually know what's going to happen in the future, but we have what happened in the past, which we can use to guess. So some information that's useful to get is that we can look at sort of when things were actually accessed. We have sort of one sort of a design for doing this is where we have sort of a reference or access bit we store for each of our page table entries, saying whether something was accessed using that entry or for other pointers to physical pages. We could do the same thing for writing with 30 bits. And this sort of information tells us about recent uses. And using this, we can approximate sort of a least recently used policy. And the idea is a least recently used policy works when we have this assumption of locality, that when we access something now, we're likely to access it again soon. And this is often true. And we saw some different ways of sort of imitating that. We had the second chance policy where we didn't do an exact least recently used. We just said, before we replace something, we're going to see if it was referenced since we last looked at it. And if not, we're going to use it. If so, we're going to put it back on our list, clearing whether it was referenced. And we had this sort of refinement of that Linux used, where we had a small list we scanned for references and a large list, usually large, that where we didn't actually look for references actively, we just let things go to the bottom of that list before we looked at them again. We also briefly mentioned that, approximating LRU is usually what we want to do, but we're assuming locality. That isn't always true, and there's some important cases where it wasn't really a thing. So, questions about these things we covered last time? Yes? The question is the reference bit the same thing that we used for? So the question is the reference bit the same thing as the reference count? No. So this is a different type of reference. So the reference count for the lab is more like a used or in page tables count, whereas this reference bit is more like an accessed thing, regardless of whether not accessible. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Yeah, what's the algorithm specifically why two different pointers, but one is copy, somehow have the same physical address?
So question, why two different pointers have the physical address? So I am not displaying quizzes right now, I guess. That is just something that is not happening. Okay. Currently, it's not a good day to have mice. So on the quiz, so the question was, we had two pointers with the same physical address. So when we think of the physical address of something, we have, I guess I should have phrased that more precisely and maybe need to be careful about that question. So the question was that saying we had two different mappings of the same file. We had P1 and P2, which were M maps of the same file, and one was a private mapping and one was a shared mapping. And we were asking about P1, 4096, and P2, 4096. And my intention is these are two different virtual addresses, and they have a corresponding physical address we get by looking up on the page table. And because, even though this was a private and a shared mapping, we hadn't used this part of the private mapping, so there was no copy and write that needed to happen, so those two page table entries could point to the same physical page. Yes?
So if something is a private mapping and you don't just automatically create a copy because it's a private mapping, you only do so whenever it's...
Question, when something's a private mapping, you don't just create a copy automatically because it's a private mapping, you only do so when it's used? Yes, we use copy on write. Yeah?
I'm confused about the difference between like when we want to get a file descriptor for something by opening it and when we want like a car pointer to it that we get from mmap.
So question, when would we use open and read versus when would we use mmap? So there's some things that open and read are more convenient for. So if you're copying the data anyways, read does that for you. Like if you're not gonna want it in the format it's in the file, you want it in different smaller pieces. It's really hard to deal with things like IO errors in mmap. How do you tell if like reading from the disk fails? You just can't use mmap for some types of files. Like I can't really use mmap to like read from the keyboard. You can use read to do that. Can't really use it to write to a terminal. Can use write to do that. Can't use mmap really. Also mmap is harder if you care about making sure things are written to disk at particular points. That's probably something that's easier to do on top of write than on top of mmap. Or if you want things to be read from the disk at a certain point, it's probably easier to do on top of read than on top of mmap. Does that answer your question? Yes?
I got a question on how specifically appy works. Like, is open read from the disk or read from memory?
So question, how does FD work? How does like a file descriptor work? So a file descriptor is going to point to some kernel data structure, and there's lots of options. But when we have a cache like we talked about, that's going to be aware of what parts of the file are cached. And it's going to use whatever copies are cached if it can. If it can't, it's going to do the same thing we do on a page fault for memory mapped IO, which is that we're going to have to load it in from the disk or whatever storage it's on.
After an mmap instruction, when will the modification to the memory read into the disk?
The question is, if I write a file through mmap, when is it written to the disk? It has to be written before we evict it from the cache, right? We don't want to forget about it. And it could be written earlier, and we'll talk about that today. But it has to be written at least before we get rid of it, right? We can't forget about the changes.
So I mean, if the open read from the disk, then before the modification made by mmap is instructed.
So the question is, if I modify a file with mmap, why do I see those modifications with read? So the read has to use the cached version if there is one. And that cached version will be what is modified via mmap.
So what about open instruction instead of read?
So what about open instead of read? So open doesn't actually read the file. It just looks up the file. So open is not going to actually look at any of the data in the file. It's just going to set things up so you can do that in the future when you call read.
So like in the setting in problem one in the quiz, so once the mmap instruction is completed, then whenever we open the modified file, it will also be modified.
When the mmap instruction is, so whenever you modify a file through mmap, we'll see those modifications immediately if we read or write the file. And it doesn't matter if we opened it before the mmap or after. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Question one, could you explain why 10 pointers do not have the same virtual address as P2?
So the question was, so we mentioned that the two pointers could have the same point to the same physical address because it's the same data and we didn't have to make a private copy, but they need to have different virtual addresses because if we did write to that location, we get different data. And that means that, you know, they can't have the same virtual address because we need to be able to have something to make point to something else on a write. And we need a separate virtual address for that. Does that answer your question? Looks can, like, maybe?
So are you saying like the two pointers cannot have the same virtual address?
So the two pointers here can't have the same virtual addresses, or any of them, because they need to behave differently. So in particular, writing to them should do different things.
Yeah, I was comparing between the pointer P2 and the 10.
Oh, pointer P2 and P3. Oh, you were asking about P3, and we had this sort of care temp. So this is also, so temp also should behave differently than, say, P2, in that if I write something to P2, it shouldn't also modify temp and vice versa at the end, right? Because if I read from a file and then modify what I read, that shouldn't change any other thing, which is reading the file.
But like the P2 was like mapped with the map.
So the P2 is mapped private, it was mapped shared, right? So if I modify temp, that better not modify P2. Because temp is supposed to be a copy of 2K of the file, right? And if I change that copy to something else, that shouldn't modify the file. But if they have the same virtual address, it has to, right? Because there's no way to distinguish writing to temp versus writing to
p2.
So the question is, is p2 a deep copy of the file? So p2 points to the actual data for the file, but temp cannot. Because temp is something that we can change and it shouldn't much affect the file.
So the temp is the copy of the file.
So temp is a deep copy, yes. Other questions? Yeah.
So if we read, we only read, we didn't write, then the physical addresses would still be the same.
So question, if we read and didn't write, yeah. The physical addresses would still be the same?
Of p1 and p2.
Of p1 and p2 could still be the same?
Yeah.
Yeah, so for the pages we only read, so we're talking about P1 and P2, so you have a private and the shared mapping. If we only read from a private mapping, it can point to the same place as the shared mapping because we don't have to make a copy yet. Yes?
You said earlier that if we modify through an mmap call that you would, like if you read or write through something that's mmap, you would see that immediately on a read or write through OpenFD.
Yeah.
Is that also true for a private mmap call?
So the question is, when I said if I modify a file through an mmap call, I see that immediately through read and write. Is that true for a private? No. So a private doesn't modify the file, right? That's not a way you can't use a private mapping to modify a file.
Okay.
Yeah.
And P1 and P2 have the same virtual address if we didn't do anything, right?
Could P2 and P2 have the same virtual address if we didn't do any write? No, because when we're returning from mmap, we have no way of knowing whether or not you're going to do a write. So we have to give you different addresses just in case. Okay. Yes.
Can we pull over question 5, choice C?
So question 5, choice C was asking about whether some library code would benefit from Linux's deviation from LRU, which was trying to do sort of don't cache if accessed once, if accessed approximately once. And my sort of intuition was, like, we're going to probably spend a bunch of time in this code and access all over the place in this code that is going to deal with loading a file. That's going to feel like more than accessing approximately once, so it won't trigger our special case, so it won't make any difference. That's what I was going for. Or, if it did make a difference, we'd be saying that if you went to load more of those files, we're going to get rid of the code you just loaded to do that, which seems like a bad idea. And it seems likely that our intuition would be that if you just loaded one of those files, maybe it's probably good to keep that code in memory. But maybe this is a little too vague and I need to change the question, drop the question. But my intention was that the way I think of code being executed, it shouldn't trigger that accessed approximately once heuristic, right? Because code typically has function calls and loops and things like that that are should very much, if it's not trivial, trigger some heuristic on this is accessed a bunch of times. Yeah. So the question is, in the explanation I said many repeated accesses, I mean from executing code. I would expect there to be a lot of accesses over a non-small period of time compared to the sort of scanning of file patterns we want to be hitting with this heuristic. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes.
So like for C, if at some point we got plenty of file of a specific format to read, then it will improve the performance will be greater than our LRU.
Question, if we had
some specific point we have plenty of file of the specific format to read.
So the question, so the reason I said I didn't check the answer in the key is I said it seems like we shouldn't be triggering this heuristic. Right, so it's not likely to help, right? That ordinarily we should be marking the file. We should not consider it as something we get rid of from the cache. And the only place where the heuristic would help is if we don't want to cache this code. Like if we have something better to cache than this code. And
yes, but maybe the frequency of the appearance of that specific format would be relatively low.
Yes, so your argument is couldn't this be something we access effectively once because we run it very quickly to load a file and never do that again? Yes, and so I guess I'm going to have to mark the question, give credit for everyone for the question, even though that's not what I was going for, because I don't think that sort of reflects how, like, parsing a file is not so simple and typically, I would think, has some locality, but yeah, I wasn't clear enough about it. Okay, so let's go on to our main topics for today. So first, to finish up, something about paging. So previously, we had this sort of reactive assumption. We were assuming that we would load something on demand only, meaning that we'd only load something when there was a page fault or some other access to it. And we can do better than this. And there's one very common way in which operating systems do better than this. So if you see a program access page 4, then page 5, then page 6, what page is next? You probably would say page 7. And this sort of access pattern, really common, especially for files. So operating systems have mechanisms to monitor program accesses to look for patterns like this and read page 7 before the program even accesses it. And this is called read ahead. So the operating system will try to guess what the program is reading right now and load that in advance to make it accesses faster rather than waiting for the program to actually trigger the load of that directly. Yes?
Why is it faster to do it proactively than to just do it?
Question, why is it faster to do it proactively? So the operating system can read from the disk while the program is still running. Or other devices it can read from while the program is still running. Yes?
Does it use like linear regression if like the page separation?
So the question is, do we use like linear regression or something like that? So the details of this vary tremendously. Sort of the basic idea is we just look for a set of contiguous indices in something and look for accesses to those pages in a time window.
So what if it was like 4, 5, 7, 10?
It's a question, what if it was 4, 5, 7, 10? So it will vary whether heuristics will do that or not. And it's sort of an OS choice whether you want to try to, you know, detect those or not. Okay. So this is sort of the primary way in which we can improve performance by being proactive. There's some other things that are useful to do, which is just about doing things in advance again. So one thing we can do is we can free up some pages a little bit before we actually need them. So I sort of talked about when we allocate a page, we need to do the work of evicting a page. Often operating systems will do this in advance, and they'll have sort of a small set of already freed pages where they've already like removed things from page tables and so on, just so allocation is faster. And the idea is that when they're removing things from page tables, they're choosing pages that are very unlikely to be used, and they can do all that work of removing them while programs don't have anything useful to do. And another thing, as I mentioned, we have to write back pages that are modified. Operating systems will generally try to do this earlier so they don't have to do it later. And in addition to helping our performance, because we don't write them out at the last moment, we can write them out while the system's not busy. This also means that we don't lose as much data on a power failure. So probably something you want the OS to do for that reason too. So that's all I'm going to have to say about page replacement and caches. We're going to go on to our next topic, which is going to be about I/O and then file systems. So questions? Yes? Can I talk about what dirty means? So dirty just means is modified in the cache. In cache, but not in the permanent storage. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question is being proactive part of LRU? No. So these are things which are kind of things you can do in addition to any replacement policy. that answer your question? Yes. Question, this is an actual replacement policy? No, these are things we're doing. So the replacement policy is when I want to free up a page, what one do I choose? Yeah. We can apply any of the replacement policies to doing that before the program actually needs them. Yeah. Writing out dirty pages is not part of a replacement policy. We aren't replacing the page. We're just writing it to disk earlier so we don't have to do it on replacement. We're just saving ourselves work on replacement. Reading in pages, that's related to a replacement policy and interacts with it. But basically we're saying, I'm gonna do replacements, do replacements even though the program's not requesting the data yet. But I'm still gonna use the replacement policy to find where do I read those into? What page do I replace to read in the new pages? Does that answer your question?
No, I still don't really see can you explain what standardized implementation is for this if we wanted to do it on top of something like LRU, what exactly?
So question, if I'm doing this on top of LRU, how does LRU interact? And LRU is how we make the decision of when I want to get a page to do something with, how do I get it? So in this case, getting a page to do something with is what page do I free? I'm going to use LRU for that. If I want to read in a page, where do I put it? I'm going to use LRU for that. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about IO. So we have a program, and your program can talk to, say, a keyboard or a disk. And we've learned sort of earlier that you make key presses. And what typically happens is those key presses don't go to your program directly, but they go to some sort of buffer. And maybe sometime later, your program will ask to read from the terminal. And if you press the keys earlier, the OS can satisfy that by just copying from the buffer. So there's going to be this buffer in the OS that we can handle reads from. And I'm sure we're showing the case where read happened earlier. It could also be the case that I asked to read first, and then the OS will wait until something is copied into the buffer and then send it out. Copy it back to return from the read call. Reading from disk is similar. I asked to read from a file, and the OS is going to arrange for that part of the disk to be in some buffer. In the case of files on disk, this would be that page cache. That would be that buffer. And it's going to satisfy the read from the buffer. So this is the sort of typical pattern we have for reads. And notice that we have sort of this internal buffer for actually communicating with the device that's separate from what you pass to read. So all read is doing is copying from that buffer, possibly waiting for it to be ready. For writing, if I want to print a character, say, to a network, the common pattern, again, is going to use buffers. So the OS is going to copy that into a buffer of output waiting to be sent, and when the network is ready, it's going to send that on the network. If I ask to write to a file, it's going to write that data to a buffer waiting to be sent to the disk. That's going to be part of our page cache, and it's going to send it to the file when the disk is ready and when the OS decides to do that. Okay, so this is sort of our typical pattern with IO. We have this indirection. We're going to talk about how we write the code that deals with talking to these buffers. And we have sort of two pieces you'll see. We have the piece that works on the system call, and we have the piece that actually communicates with the device. And we're going to talk about both of those pieces, and they're typically going to be separate from each other. Okay. In talking about this, I should talk about buffering a little more. So I mentioned that we have buffers in the kernel, and these are buffers used by read and write. Typically, when you're doing I/O, you will use things like cout or printf. These have additional buffers. So for example, printf, very commonly, won't actually call write right away. It will instead send stuff to a buffer, and then it will write that out in a big chunk. And that means that, we're going to have sort of waiting output here and waiting output here. So we're going to have two places where we have waiting output stored, which seems wasteful. Maybe it is. But sort of the idea is that the buffers in the standard library are avoiding calling write too often, and the buffers in the kernel are dealing with write not always matching up with when we want to talk to the device. Okay. So this is sort of a general pattern. And I have something on here, which is device drivers. So device drivers, this is going to be the part of the kernel that talks to devices. To devices like keyboards, networks, and so on. We're going to talk about how that works. And sort of on a Unix-like system, there's actually two ways you access those. So you like you use read-write, or use a library which uses read-and-write, or mmap, and you can access regular files. In the case of regular files, there's this extra layer of indirection called a file system, which is how we have one disk with lots of subdivided into all these pieces we call files, called regular files. We also have other types of devices, and we're going to represent those as a file too, and I'm going to call those files device files. So these are for things like a disk, or an external terminal, or an audio device, and so on. So these are going to have the same interface as files, but they're going to sort of go directly to the device driver rather than having this indirection to like split up some storage into multiple pieces, which is what a file system does. So device drivers are going to implement this file interface to talk to some special devices. And on a, as an example, on my Linux desktop, I have these devices. These are device files, so these are files I can open and read and write to. So for example, there's a device with this funny name here for audio playback. I can open and write audio data to it, and it will go out my speakers. So that doesn't act like a regular file, like a file on disk. Just open that, I write to it, it sends audio to my speakers. I have devices which can directly ASCII my SSDs and disks. Rather than using the file system. So rather than accessing part of that, like that's a file, I can access the whole thing all at once using a file directly, the device. I have devices that represent the mouse and keyboard. I can open them and read keyboard movements and key presses and mouse movements and key presses. I have a device which represents the monitor. I can open it and send stuff to display on the monitor. So often when we think about these devices, we're going to open, read, write, mmap. Often that's not quite enough. So sometimes there will be some extra operations that these support. And the way POSIX, Unix decided to do this, is that they have this sort of generic system call called IOCTL, which is just some sort of device operation that doesn't fit within read or write. So for example, you know, maybe there's some operation to figure out if headphones are plugged in on the audio output device, which doesn't sort of naturally fit with your write, or to set what format the audio is going to be in. Or on the terminal, maybe there's some operation to change whether I see what I type immediately or not. Or for like a CD or DVD drive, maybe there's some operation to open the tray or something like that, these would often be implemented as these extra IOCTL operations. But ultimately, the device driver is just implementing sort of the operations we can do on a file. So these include, you know, when we open a device file, read and write, and also include this special IOCTL. They may or may not support mmap, so like mmapping a keyboard doesn't make much sense. So probably wouldn't be supported, but for some devices it would, and the device driver can implement that. And on Linux, this is sort of the data structure that's used for where a device driver specifies, here are the operations I implement, here's what read does, here's what write does, so they can make that do whatever is appropriate for the type of device they're dealing with. Now, this doesn't actually work very well for hard drives. For hard drives, we want to work with the page cache. And Unix sort of has this distinction between what are called block devices versus character devices. So character devices, we can use read and write, we can read and write bytes. Block devices kind of work in pages. And on Linux and most other Unix-likes, the device drivers for those have a different interface. And the main thing they have is read or write a page. And that's the operation that the page cache is going to use to actually talk to the device, rather than something that looks like read or write. So questions on sort of the device files and the types of operations we can provide. So we can have the open read-write interface. You have this special interface that the page cache wants, because the page cache doesn't deal with bytes like read and write, it deals with pages. Yes?
So with character devices, we have like sub-page level resolution where you can read-write increments less than a page, but for block devices, you can only write.
So questions for character devices, we have sub-page resolution? Yes, and that's because the device driver is implementing this read call, which takes a number of bytes, and similar for write. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes? Can I explain the code on this slide? So this is a struct of function pointers. So this is a function pointer that is filled in by the device driver. Does that answer your question?
Is it a header file?
This question, is this in a header file? Yes. So this is basically something Linux does because they're using C and not C++. So if we're doing C++, these would all be virtual abstract functions.
Could you explain the inputs, like the file?
Can I explain the inputs? So the file is the device file. So the file the device driver's implemented, so there's a structure representing that. This is a pointer to user memory that the __ user indicates. It points to user memory, not kernel memory. And for the most part, these map to the system calls. The system call implementation for read is going to call this read function, depending on what, if you opened up a device file. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes.
Question,
what's the difference between a device file and a device driver? So the device file is the thing you can access as a file on, like a file on disk, that is implemented by the device driver.
What do you mean by implemented?
So in the kernel, the code that gets run when I open this file and write to it, open any of these files and write to it, is going to be the part of the device driver. And the device driver is the code that knows how to talk to the device, implements it, but the device file is the interface, the thing I can open, read, write, and map, and so on.
So is the device file code then?
So the device file code, no. The device files is a file.
Yeah.
Like, it will appear in LS, and it's how you call the code that actually talks to the device. It's by accessing that file.
So does it call the code or something?
So the question, does it call the code? When you open it and do things with it, yes. So is it like an exec script? No. So it is a file where opening it, rather than accessing data, runs this device driver.
Is that what an executable script is?
Isn't that what an executable script is? To run an executable, you exec it. This is not a process. It's not user code. This is code in the kernel that you call by opening it and reading and writing the file. Yes? What's the point of having a block device? So this is that the page cache doesn't really like the read and write interface. That's not how the page cache loads things. It loads them a page at a time. It doesn't need to handle individual bytes, which is what the other interface is intended for. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes?
Can you go back to the flow and
question, the inode and the LFT. So I would say we're not going to test on any of this. I just want you to know there's a read and write operation. The inode is a way of representing a file with a name, basically. We'll look at what inodes are in more detail later. And the LFT is where in the file we are, because that's not actually tracked in the struct file on Linux. They just decided to track it elsewhere. So we said that the way we're going to run device drivers is by accessing a file. And when we read or write, they're kind of going to be magical, and they're actually going to talk to a device. They're going to actually like send audio out rather than storing data. So how does this work? So our device driver is going to have two pieces. We're going to have a piece that handles that, say, write call to write audio. And that's going to get an I/O request and figure out what to do with it. And we're going to have a bottom half, which is going to be run from our exception handler. So devices often are going to trigger exceptions when they're either ready for input or they have stuff for the kernel to read. And so we'll go through how these work with the example of the XV6 keyboard input device. So in XV6, we get input from the keyboard. And in XV6, I show you Linux has this sort of big complicated struct of device file operations. On XV6, there's an equivalent struct. It's really short. This is the struct for operations on a device file. And there's a device file called console for accessing the keyboard and the screen. We're going to look at the read side of it. And so we have these operations which take a struct inode. The inode represents the file on disk that points to this device. And generally, what XV6 does is the file just contains an ID, which is an index into this table of the possible devices. So for example, on boot, XV6 has a console file that points to the device for the console, which has the ID number in this array of the console. Yes?
So actually, when you think about the device, it's just like hardware?
Question, the device is just the hardware? So the device is, yeah, so the device in this case is what we call the console, which represents the keyboard and the screen. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And so reading from the console reads from the keyboard, writing to the console shows something on the screen. And we're going to have something, pointers we're going to fill in this table here that are going to point to functions that read from the keyboard and write to the screen. Yes? Question, is this basically the first box from device driver flow? Yes. So we're walking through what that looks like in XV6. So this is where the entry points are. And at boot, XV6 sets them to point to two different functions for ID1, one called console read, one called console write, which are implement the actual talking to the device. So let's look at what console read does. And console read is going to do these two steps. So it's going to deal with a buffer. It's going to first check, hey, I want to read some key presses. Do I already have them buffered? Do I already have them stored somewhere? And if so, we're just going to return that. If not, we're going to wait until there is buffered data, possibly making sure that we're actually retrieving it. In the case of the keyboard, there's no need to like send anything to the device because it's just constantly giving us data. We just need to use it. So here's the code that implements that read function. It's going to look to see, are we at the end of the buffer? R is the reading location, W is the writing location in the buffer. And if we're at the end of the buffer, it puts the thread to sleep and waits until there is something. And the question is, well, what's going to wake up this thread that's being put to sleep? That's going to be the exception handler that I'm going to show you later. So here, this just looks for the buffer and waits for something. Yes? Question, is the buffer an array? I will show you what the buffer is when I show you how we copy from it to return from read. Yes? Question, how does this check if it reaches the end? So R is the index we read from, W is the index that's being written, that was last written to. So if they're equal, we write everything. Does that answer your question?
So like if they're equal, that means that there's nothing in the buffer.
Question, if they're equal, that means there's nothing in the buffer that hasn't been read already. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So if
by satisfaction from buffers, you mean like whether or not it's reached the end of the buffer?
Question, by satisfaction from buffers, I mean whether it's not reached the end of the buffer? So, not quite. So let's look at the code for copying the data. So what we're going to do here is we're going to take something from the buffer. We're going to take a character from the buffer, copy it to the pointer the user passed in, and we're going to keep doing that until we reach some ending condition. And the ending conditions here are we've read as much as the user requested, or we've reached a new line. And if that doesn't happen, we're going to go back to that code I showed you earlier. So for example, let's say I asked to read 10 characters, I see 5 and no new line. I'm going to go back to this code here because I'm going to be at r is now going to be equal to w. I've read everything that's there, and I wasn't done with my read call. I'm going to put the thread to sleep until I can finish, until there's more stuff in the buffer for me to copy. Does that answer your question?
So in that example, you reach the end.
In this example, I reached the end, but I'm not finished with this while loop.
And because even though you're not finished with it, you're still done with the buffer.
And I'm not finished with it, but there's nothing for me, but I can't keep going because there's nothing for me to copy from the buffer yet. So here is the code that I showed you earlier, which is wait if buffer is empty now. After we read from it, yes. So we read from the buffer if we can. We wait if the buffer is empty until we've satisfied the user's request. We've read the number of characters the user wants to read or reached to the end of the line.
By buffer, do you mean like the key
press input? By buffer, I mean the key press input. The buffer, this buffer, since this is for is where the key presses are going to go, we're going to see how that happens in a minute. Question was the definition of buffer. Buffer is an array of storage for key presses in this case. But it's storage for stuff that hasn't, that, you know, it's temporary storage. In this case, it's temporary storage for stuff that we've gotten from the device but haven't read yet. Yes? Question is this reading from a buffer to the file? It's reading from the buffer to this desk pointer here. I'll show you here. This desk pointer. And this is the pointer that was passed to read. So it's reading to wherever the user told us to read into from the buffer. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So why do we use while loop instead of just an if case in the previous slide?
Question, why do we use a while loop instead of just an if case in here? So question after sleeping. Probably the biggest reason is that if we have two different things reading from the keyboard at the same time, one of them could wake up first and get the stuff from the buffer before we do. And we want to make sure we don't read something in the buffer that isn't actually there. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
How are we implementing input.r?
How are we implementing input.r? That's done as part of the reading operation. A part of the copying operation, yes. Where does the input struct come from? This is a global variable, and we'll see where it gets filled in next. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
What's input
the value? So we'll show you where input.w is set and where the buffer is filled in next. So this code is just assumes something else fills in the buffer. So all the stuff that runs on read just accesses the buffer. It doesn't actually do anything to get stuff from the keyboard. So it's just going to wait for the buffer to fill up, going to copy from the buffer, check if we're done, and if not, we're going to go back to the beginning. So that's all the read implementation does. We aren't actually doing anything specific to a keyboard here. So how do we actually fill in this buffer? So that's going to be done when exceptions happen. So we're going to have an interrupt happen, and that's going to trigger run the trap function. And the trap function has this case for the keyboard. So this that trap number represents a keyboard told the processor, hey, there's input for you to read. And we have this keyboard interrupt function, which actually handles communicating with the keyboard device. And then we have this function which says, I'm done handling this exception. So stop telling me about a CPU. So let's talk about this keyboard interrupt function, which is where the actual reading happens. So this keyboard interrupt function is going to actually add data to the buffer. It's going to change that write pointer. It's going to fill in the buff. And also, it's going to wake up anyone who's sleeping, waiting for more input. So this is where the actual work of communicating with the device is done. So the question is, how do we actually talk to a keyboard device? Like, what sort of instructions do we have to write to do that? And to talk about that, we should talk about how devices are connected. And I'm going to show you sort of one way this could be done. This is maybe not the only way of implementing it. And what we're going to say is we're going to have our processor connected via the memory bus to the memory. And we're going to attach some other things besides memory and besides other processors, other cores, to that bus, which I'll call device controllers. And these device controllers will actually talk to things like the keyboard. And the device controller is going to have what we'll call control registers, which are going to have memory addresses. And that means that the processor is going to be able to access these special control registers on the device controller by reading or writing a memory location. And rather than going to memory, it will go to this special piece of hardware we call a device controller that, for example, knows how to actually communicate with the keyboard hardware. And because this special hardware is handling reads and writes to these memory locations, they don't have to act like memory. So we expect memory, like we read a value, it just changes a number somewhere, or it copies a number. We write a value, just writes it, puts a number somewhere. Accessing values here could actually, you know, cause events to happen with the external hardware because this device controller can do whatever it wants on a read or write. So it can make this sort of memory very magical. That, you know, writing this memory doesn't just change a value, it also does something with an external device. Or reading this memory doesn't just change the value, it also like updates a counter or something like that. Okay, so sort of questions on this idea that we're gonna have devices that just are, we interface with them by reading and writing memory locations. We just have some hardware that implements an interface based on reading and writing memory locations. Yes?
What are the buffers and the queues inside?
What are the buffers and the queues? We'll talk about that briefly later. But we might not be enough to have some sort control registers is to communicate with the device is going to be our answer. Yes?
Why exactly do we need this table when we didn't need it before?
Why do we need this
table?
So I'm just saying, well, we could just have one control register. I'm just showing the general case. But we're going to have some special memory locations assigned to the device. That's the important thing. And here I'm showing we have a bunch because we could have a bunch, but we could just have one too. But we have some locations where reading or writing those locations actually talks to this special hardware called the device control. Does that answer your question?
Like, aren't you storing the statuses in a separate data structure?
Question, aren't I storing the statuses in a separate data structure? So this status register isn't part of the kernel. This is something the hardware is managing. Does that answer your question? And how it works is going to be how the hardware wants it to work, not anything the kernel might want. So this data structure here is not going to be like input.w. This is going to be some interface defined by the hardware for the hardware's convenience. Okay, and I mentioned there's going to be buffers and queues, so often we'll want to have the device give the device controller like not just like a single number, but like, you know, a lot of data. Like if we're talking to a disk, we might want to give it like several kilobytes to write. We'll put that in a buffer and queue that might be stored on the device controller. We'll access that at like we access memory. Except instead of being stored in memory, it will be stored in this special hardware that say talks to a hard drive if it's for a disk. And I sort of show you this example here that we have our devices directly on the memory bus. Often, there's some indirection. So if you think of USB, USB stands for Universal Serial Bus. It's not a memory bus. But there's some bus adapter that converts from what the memory bus expects to what USB expects. And that's how the device drivers for things on USB work. So they talk to this bus adapter, which knows how to use the device controllers on the USB. We're not going to go into like all the details of that, but So we often, but we just know that we often have sort of layers of indirection in the hardware because not all the devices speak the way the memory protocol. But that's fine. We have sort of interfaces in between that will. But what we ultimately get at this is that devices are going to expose these sort of memory locations that are kind of magical. So for example, a keyboard controller, we might have a memory location that we can read from to get the last key press value, get the key that was last pressed or released. And this memory location can be more than just storage. So for example, often reading the location will clear the buffer and set it up for the next key press or release to be recorded by the hardware. And that's something the hardware can do because it sees all the reads. It can have special hardware that does something when there's a read. And also, we'll get an interrupt whenever there's a key press we haven't read. And the hardware knows if we've read it because it does this clearing the buffer operation. Okay. So this sort of magic memory location. For a display controller, if we write pixels to a memory location, they can just be shown on the screen. And maybe some other memory locations will change, like the size of the screen that's displayed and so on. For a network interface, maybe we write to some buffer on the device controller and then write a send now signal, and that triggers that buffer to be copied to the network. And then we read from a status location and some buffers to figure out receiving. So the key thing is that these device controllers can like set up whatever interface is convenient for them to talk to the type of device they have, and this is going to be different for different devices, and that's fine. But ultimately, it's just going to be memory reads and writes that the kernel does to talk to these devices. And also running things in exception handlers, which these device controllers will trigger when they need to. So for example, we mentioned keyboard controller probably going to trigger interrupts when you have things you haven't read that you might be interested in. Questions about this notion of sort of magic memory to represent devices? Yeah?
Where exactly is the magic part coming from?
Where's the magic part? So I'm saying magic because these memory locations act very differently than normal memory locations, right? Like reading from a memory location shouldn't change anything, but it can with these memory locations. Writing to a memory location like normally doesn't cause something to happen besides storing a value, but it can with these. That's why I'm saying they're magic.
So what is this new thing that happens?
What?
So what's the new thing that happens?
What's the new thing that happens? It depends on what the device controller decides, but for example, for a network controller, there's going to be some memory location you write to that sends a whole bunch of stuff out on the network. It depends how the network controller works. So for Wi-Fi, like a Wi-Fi packet, which is going to be not just one little thing, it's going to be like a kilobyte or something.
So it's magic because it's just sending more information?
It's magic because it's not acting like normal memory. That's what I'm saying, right? It's not normal memory. You can't use it like normal memory. Like you can't store your stack in this and expect anything to work. It's going to do lots of other things when you read and write it.
So in this diagram, what exactly is like the other stuff that's going to be done to the device controller?
Yeah, it's whatever the device. So accessing these locations does something with the external hardware. And what it does depends on the device controller. Other questions? Okay. So one thing about this that we have to be a little careful about is I mentioned that a keyboard controller might have a memory location that gives us the last key press and release. And if you remember learning about processor caches from some prior course, you may think, wait a moment, don't we cache that memory location on the processor? And the answer is usually yes. But this would be bad, because this would mean if the OS like reads H, then I type an E, the OS reads from that memory location, it gets the cached value on the processor and doesn't go to the device controller. And that's not something we want. So how do we deal with this? And the solution is that there is usually a mechanism for the OS to mark memory as uncacheable, to have the processor not put it in the cache just to support these device controllers. And in x86, there's a bit you can set in the page table entries to disable caching for this purpose. Okay, so let's look at the actual code that uses these sort of magic memory locations in XV6. And when I talk about this, I need to talk about something which is kind of a historical artifact of XV6. So I sort of said, oh, our devices are going to have memory addresses that are just normal memory addresses that behave differently, normal physical memory addresses. X86 has this history where they have sort of a separate set of I/O addresses, which act like memory addresses, but you have to write them using a different instruction, namely in or out instead of move. But otherwise, they act like memory. They're just written with in, out instead of move. More recent processors and devices generally don't use separate memory addresses. They just use normal memory addresses. We just assign some physical addresses to devices and some to normal memory, rather than having sort of separate I/O addresses like historically was done. But XV6 is historical, so it has this separate I/O addresses from memory addresses. So with that in mind, we have our magic memory for our keyboard. We have two control registers to access. We have a status register, which has a particular address that's just assigned statically by the hardware. And we have a data register, again with another address. And what the exception handler for key presses on XV6 does is it checks the status register, it reads from it, and sees what its value is. And if the status register says there's no data, it just finishes. If it does say there's data, it reads from the data buffer. Reading from that clears it, and it gets the key press in here, and then it copies that to the buffer after figuring out what it means. In fact, the key presses are stored in a different format than we expect in the buffer. For example, they like tell you not just did I press an A, but did I press an A or release an A? Like both, that's information there. Some questions? This code, yes. The question is, how do I write a program to use a keyboard driver when I don't have a keyboard driver yet for a system? Is that your question? So usually the bootstrapping process is that I write code on a different system for my new system. And when that doesn't work, there's systems you can program without keyboards. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
When we're reading from data, does that mean that reading from the buffer?
The question is, reading from the data, reading from the buffer? No. So what's going to happen? So this is from the device controller. So what we're going to do here is then we're going to copy data to the buffer. Is what this code is going to do afterwards.
This clears
the device controller buffer. So we have two sort of buffers here. We have one in the device controller, which only stores one character, and one in the kernel, which stores a lot more stuff. That answer your question? Yes. How does an I/O address differ from regular address? It's just a separate, so a way they could have implemented it is we just could have said certain addresses are used for I/O. They just decided to specify that you need to use a different instruction to access I/O devices. And addresses are interpreted differently by that instruction. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Or I/O address versus like physical, they're most analogous to physical addresses, but as I said, it's like interpreted differently, so they aren't the same as either. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes?
Does it mean a data buffer is 4-byte long?
Question, does this mean the data buffer is 4-byte long? This, no, because this is in bytes, so this only reads a byte from it. They just happen to be 4 bytes apart. They happen to be 4 bytes apart in addresses, but they're each 1 byte values. Other questions? Okay. So what I've shown you so far is what's called programmed I/O. And what this means is that in this design, like when we want to communicate with devices, we send our commands to do stuff, and our data to the device or read it from the device directly. And typically for something like a disk, this means we're gonna run some loop to send stuff to the device controller or from it. We're gonna talk about another mechanism in a bit besides this that's a little more efficient. But something you might notice that's not so great about this is that we're doing a lot of code to like read something from the device a little bit at a time. And we'd like to avoid that. We'll talk about how to do that later. But first, let's sort of talk about a scenario to make sure we understand what goes on here. So let's say I have an application A that's reading from the network, and B that's doing a lot of computation, doesn't do any I/O. Let's say A tries to read 8 kilobytes from the network. The data is not there. Then, sometime later, 16K comes in, and then it reads another 4K that should be satisfied immediately. My question is, how many mode switches, how many context switches? I'll give you a minute or two. Question? The last call to read is included. The last call to read is on the timeline is included. Question? So, question, how many kilobytes are in the recall? I'm telling you the size of the recalls, and please assume that the recall gets exactly the size requested. Do I have to call the recall multiple times if it's 8 kilobytes? So I can call read with a size argument of 8 kilobytes, and that's what I'm assuming is happening. It's one system call. From the network. When I say 60 kilobytes coming in, it comes in from the network. So you have to communicate with the network's device controller to get that, because it's on the network device controller. It's not anywhere else. Why do we mark the memory uncacheable? Because the processor cache doesn't know that writing and reading the memory should do something special, and it's not going to implement that functionality, right? It's just going to, like, if we read from the keyboard using that, it's going to cache the private value we read, not knowing it. We need to check for a new one. Well, because we know that it's not normal memory, right? We know that we need to go to the device controller to see if the value changed. Okay, so who would like some? Seems like people are still working a bit. Okay, so let's see. So who thinks we have at least 4 mode switches? Okay. Who thinks less than 4 mode switches? A bunch of people think less than 4 mode switches. Okay. So who thinks at least 5 mode switches? 6? 7? 8, at least 8? Okay. So, guess we need to talk about it. And how about context switches? Who thinks we have at least 2 context switches? Okay. More than 2 context switches? Okay, so most people think 2 context switches, more than 2, huge split on number of mode switches. So I have a timeline written out here. So let's go through what happens here. So initially, A is running in user mode. It makes a system call that switches from user to kernel mode. And we're going to run the top half of the device driver. It's going to check to see, hey, do I have data buffered? Answer's no. So what's it going to do? It's going to put the program to sleep. That means we're going to switch to user mode to process B. So this is a context switch and a mode switch. And this is a mode switch and this is a mode switch. Well, I'll actually have a slide later on that counts them. So we run process B, and then data comes on the network. That's going to trigger an exception from the network device controller telling us, hey, I have data for you to handle. And we're going to run some code that copies from the device to the buffer. And that's going to wake up process A that previously was reading. And there's 2 options. As a result of waking it up, we could just run it right away, in which case we'll switch to process A and copy from the buffer to where we're supposed to read and then return. Or we could decide, not that important, let's continue running process B for a bit. We'll handle process A later, after we've done giving process B some time to run. Either's fine. And after process B runs, we're going to have a second read system call. In this case, we're going to copy stuff from the buffer. We're going to find out, oh, I still have 8K left in the buffer. I can get 4K out of that. And so we're not going to have to wait. And so for mode switches, I count at least 6. And counting in both directions. If you only count in one direction, that's 3. So some of you may have been counting differently. I should have probably been clearer about that. But 3 switches in either direction, or 6 switches in either direction, 3 switches from user to kernel, 3 switches from kernel to user. I'm counting both types of switches. And I have possibly 8 or 4 in one direction to run process B in the middle. And for context switches, I have 2. Or possibly, I have 2. So, yeah.
The network error wakes up the process A. Does that mean that it necessitates that it'll be run by the schedule, or did it just make marks?
Question, when I say it wakes up, when I say we wake up process A from the bottom half of the device controller, does that necessitate runs in a way? So in XP6, we'd implement this by just marking it as runnable and letting the scheduler do its thing, and that's typically how it's going to work. Maybe if our scheduling policy says we should run it right away, we probably will. So like we have a strict priority policy that says it has higher priority, we'll run it right away, and if not, we won't. Does that answer your question? Yeah. The question is, what are these switches represent? What are these 1 and 2?
So after you switch from user mode A to B, which is the yellow line, and then you switch to the green line, the user mode B, right? Does that constitute 2 switches for kernel and user mode?
Question is, why is this? So the question is getting from running B in user mode to running A in user mode just 2 switches? 2 mode switches? Yes. So I'm switching to kernel mode to handle the system call. And that system call, after we decide to not keep running A, switches to user mode to go back to running the code that was in B.
I mean, like, so how long does it wait?
What?
How long does it wait for in the kernel mode?
The question is, how long does it wait in the kernel mode?
Yeah.
So we're not waiting in the kernel mode, right? The operation we're doing here is we're just doing enough to see that there's nothing in the buffer. Let's find out what else to run. That's all we're doing in this part. Does that answer your question?
So why does the user mode program need to start right away after?
question, why does it start right away after, the question is, why did I say run B while it waits? Why does user mode B start right away? So I'm not showing some small amount of logic that might happen in kernel mode in program B to go back to running it. Does that answer your question? Yes.
After the second read syscall from program A, we not switch to other program?
Question, after the second read syscall, do we not switch to another program? We have no reason to, because we can satisfy that read system call right away from the buffer. Right? We don't have to wait for any inputs. Does that answer your question? Because remember, our scenario was that I asked for 8K first, I got 16, so I still have 8K left to read, and I can read another 4K without waiting. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Question, what if it's reading 8 kilobytes, why does 16 kilobytes come in? So the assumption is that the network gets data coming in. At whatever rate, the things in the network are putting it in. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
How exactly does this directly relate to program.io?
How does this relate to program.io? So in program.io, so that means that we're spending time here actually doing the copy. Sorry, it doesn't directly relate to program.io, but okay. I wanted to mention program.io to know that you have to do that copy.
So is it like the infrastructure that we're supposed to use? Like
I probably should have put program.io later, but the program.io is we're doing a copy there. Okay, so there's an alternative to program.io where instead of doing that copy, we have the device do it. And why can we do this? Well, what we can do instead is we can, rather than having the device have a buffer that we need to copy to and from, we can have the OS set an address we want the device to access. And the device is on the memory bus. So rather than having the OS read from the device's buffer and read from the buffer, send that to the processor, then send that back to some place in memory where it's storing things, we can tell the device, hey, what my buffer's in this memory location, you write to it for me, or you read from it for me. And this is called direct memory access. So rather than doing that copying loop, we just tell the device, hey, here's where my kernel buffer is, you write to it or you read from it directly, because you're on the memory bus, you can do that. So this is called direct memory access. And it saves a step when it's done. And it's for network and disk I/O, it's much faster. So we'd really like to do it because it avoids a loop to run data. We still need to handle copying from that buffer back to user stuff and knowing when that buffer gets filled and so on. But this is generally a lot more efficient, and maybe it results in the device putting the data where the OS wants it directly, if it's used. And so here, we still have our device registers for communicating information about, do I want to read it right now? Am I ready? But we actually store the data in memory and have the device controller access it directly. Okay, so questions on direct memory access? Yeah?
Can we write directly to cache, or we have to write to
Question, can it write directly to cache? That depends on how the memory bus works. Other questions? Okay, so that's where I'll leave off today. I was hoping to start file systems, but we'll deal with starting them next time.